You have found InnoTalks. My name is Roman Jurovetsky, Assistant Professor in Innovation Studies and Data Science at Aalborg University in Denmark. And in this show, I interview experts and researchers working with innovation. Innovation is a rather broad discipline, and sometimes our discussions revolve around societal challenges. Other episodes explore more the innovation that happens within companies, but often those are interrelated and intertwined. So today, my friend and colleague Daniel Hein joins as a co-host to interview Juan Mateus Garcia. We connect to Juan in London. Juan is a director of innovation mapping at Nesta in the UK. Nesta is an innovation foundation that works with areas where there are big challenges facing society. And our discussion centers around innovation indicators, meaning that we look at how we actually measure innovation in practice. No measure is perfect, and so we discuss existing approaches as well as new techniques that become available with more data being available, as well as machine learning techniques coming into the space. And all of that opens, of course, for higher granularity and new insights. More generally, I would like to say that I'm very happy. In the last week, I received many very encouraging notes from people who found the podcast and found the content interesting. So thanks a lot for that. I don't have a marketing team or a budget to promote this podcast more widely. So if you find this podcast interesting and useful, consider sharing it within your social networks or forward it to your colleagues or friends that may be interested in innovation. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen, and you will never miss an episode when it comes out. Also, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. And now, without further delay, let's jump straight into the interview with Juan Mateus Garcia. Okay, with me on the line today is, actually I have a co-host today, that's my colleague Daniel Hein.
Hello everybody.
And we are joined by Juan, and Juan works at Nesta in the UK and is doing many exciting things there, including developing new innovation indicators, innovation mapping, policy. And Juan, maybe you just go ahead and introduce yourself before I just say weird things about you.
Sure thing, Roman. So, I'm Juan Mateus Garcia. I'm Director for Innovation Mapping at Nesta. Nesta is an innovation foundation in the UK. So it's not an academic institution. It's an NGO, and its mission is to basically support innovation for the common good. We do this through a bunch of things. So Nesta has a grant giving part. We also have a venture capital side. We also do lots of practical programs. We organize challenge prizes for innovators, and then we also do a lot of research. And on the research side, a lot of what we do, I guess, has to do with novel data sources and methods, like data science methods and network science and complexity science and, I guess, interactive visualization. And ultimately, our goal is to use all of these methods to create a more, relevant, inclusive, timely, and open understanding of what innovation happens and how innovation happens, so that we can support it more effectively. And I guess maybe to say something about myself, I'm an economist. I did a master's in science and technology policy at the Science Policy Research Unit. I was in academia for quite a while, and then I moved into Nesta. And I guess over time, I went from a situation where I was a very kind of traditional kind of economist using data in tables and analyzing it with Stata and things like that, to, I guess, start to work with weirder kind of data and methods. And I guess over time, learning how to use Python, I guess picking up some data science skills, some machine learning skills, and I guess working on various projects and starting to build up a bit of a team over time. And now we have a team of around 10 people. Data science, data developers, data visualization engineers, user research people, working in projects with the European Commission, with the World Bank, collaborating with the OECD, like various governments in different parts of the UK, like Scottish government, Welsh government, our innovation agency, Innovate UK, UK Research and Innovation, the Department for Business. So I guess lots of like different policy clients that we work with, and ultimately always trying to use novel data sources and methods to create information that can help them to make better decisions. And I guess as a side effect, and the reason I know Roman and Daniel is that even though we are not an academic institution, we still like to write papers, and we like to our research to go into conferences and peer-reviewed journals. So a lot of what we do is create interesting data sets through the projects we do. And then we basically, in addition to giving them to policymakers and hopefully helping them to make better decisions, we also write papers on the back of that. And I guess this connects us to academic communities and researchers so, like Roman and Daniel.
Thanks so much for joining. I think like when I was thinking about, you know, whom should I talk to about innovation performance, innovation indicators, then you were the first person that popped up in my head, like, okay, you're the person, I guess, to talk about these things. And I think let's start with a more general question. And, you know, for the longest time, we've been talking about innovation systems, maybe for the last 20 years. And, you know, what is innovation system performance for you, if you think about that? It is a big question.
Wow. Okay.
It's a very open question, yes.
So I guess like for me, it is, I guess it's a system that has the right balance of exploration and exploitation, right? So basically you have a bunch of like research and business capabilities and networks and things like that, which are enabling the system to, I guess, develop new ideas and discover new ideas, but also not just develop come up with new ideas, but also be able to exploit them and create, I guess, value from them that stays inside of the system. Goodness, you know, at the end of the day, this is what's going to allow the system to be sustainable and also, I guess, be able to respond to changes in the situation, like disruptive innovations or, I guess, shocks like the one we're seeing us right now with COVID.
I mean, exploration and exploitation, most of the time when we talk about these systems, right, it's kind of maybe we're a little bit biased towards exploration. Could that be? I'm not sure.
I think that has to do with I guess for me, because I work a lot with policymakers, like the big, like, I guess, policy lever that research and innovation policymakers have is public funding for R&D. You know, there's like a bias towards thinking about the, I guess, almost like the, I guess like the front end of R&D, like more researchy stuff and creation of knowledge and creation of new ideas, rather than how they are exploited. Because the idea is that that's what the private sector does, and they need to worry a bit less about it. Obviously, we know like from the productivity puzzle and the fact that. We are seeing a slowdown in productivity growth. There's a sense that even though we're coming up with, you know, like university labs and corporate labs and lots of different places are coming up with amazing ideas and emerging technologies and all of these kind of cool new tech, you know, there seems to be a problem in how these things are actually being exploited and adopted in the private sector. And over time, policymakers are starting to think a bit more about how these ideas are adopted and spread into the private sector and create an economic impact there. But I feel like it's fair to say that's not very developed. Like my perception is that area of policy thinking is much less developed than the area of actually supporting R&D and coming up with the new ideas in the first place.
I mean, and it's also something that I know Daniel has been also doing a little bit about that, or teaching also some of these indicators and, you know, what can be done and what has been done already, and, you know, maybe where we should be going there. But Daniel, yeah, you had something to say as well, I guess, about that.
Yeah, this terminology of exploitation, exploration is a very interesting and helpful one, I find. I, at the moment, wonder how do you think about in terms of what are data sources which are appropriate to measure explorative or exploitative activities? As I see it in practice, most of the time you would equate exploration with system inputs, with measures like how much do we spend on R&D, how much teaching facility, how many academic research facilities do we have, and exploitation with output.
Yeah.
So how many patents do we produce? Is that the way how you see it as well? Or might there be more clever ways to think about it in terms of data source you can use to analyze it?
Yeah, I guess like, I mean, that's, I guess that's somewhat like the starting point, you know, and I guess like even the simpler measures of activity, like both in terms of exploration and exploitation are already useful. But I guess, you know, in a way, what we miss when we just look at these kinds of like, I guess, flows of money and intellectual property, I guess, outputs is, well, I mean, we know that some sectors patent, lots of sectors don't patent. So actually, we're going to miss exploitation in lots of industries if we just look at patents. I guess, you know, you could say, okay, let's look at trademarks, let's look at new product launches, let's look at things like cooler kind of novel methods like open source software and things like that. But I think it's still like, even if you continue looking at all of those areas, you're still missing something that's very important, which is the presence of innovation capabilities inside of organizations. And I guess this is where we are getting into adoption. You know, you could have an amazing kind of like, I don't know, you could imagine like a high frequency trading kind of like financial services company that's not patenting. This company is not publishing. This company is not receiving grants from government, or at least not research grants. Maybe they are receiving some other sorts of subsidies. But they are, you know, they are exploiting like cutting edge technologies and cutting edge, advances in science, for example, around machine learning and AI and things like that. You know, and the question here is how can you measure like that kind of diffusion or adoption or exploitation of new ideas in businesses when they are not patenting and they are not, producing these kinds of traditional outputs, you know, and that's where I guess you get into an interesting kind of like measurement challenge. And I think that's where some of the novel data sources can be quite interesting. Like, I think in the case of like a high frequency trading example, I think probably you wouldn't be able to use, say, like some of the things we use in Nesta, like looking at business websites to see what they talk about, because we know that high frequency trading firms, I guess, they don't even have websites. Like they are just like completely like opaque. But you know, in some other cases, like for example, looking at software companies, looking at video games, looking at, you know, other companies which are maybe a bit more open about what they do and how they use technology, then in principle, you could look at their websites, you know, and try to understand whether they are mentioning technologies in a way that suggests that they are exploiting them. And that's what we did in a project looking at the immersive economy in the UK, you know, with things like virtual reality, augmented reality, haptics, all of those kinds of cool new technologies that we know obviously are being developed and are very exciting, almost like as an R&D site, but also are being adopted in lots of industries in interesting ways, like, I don't know, like augmented reality being used in construction sites, you know, and if you wanted to pick up that kind of application, actually, one way to look at that, say, for example, for a construction company that's using it but is not developing it, is to see whether they are mentioning it in its website as an example of, I guess, something they do that makes them an attractive kind of provider for another company in the market. So business websites can be an interesting source. Another one which I haven't used yet, but I'm really like keen to work with and hopefully going to be working with in the coming months, is actually looking at online job ads. And here the idea is that if a business is developing, you know, our high frequency trading example, if a business is developing capabilities around AI, around machine learning, then it's going to be hiring people with the relevant skills. And very often what businesses are doing is advertising this, you know, like in websites, in like job ads places and so forth. Again, maybe like the high frequency trading example, I don't know how public they would be about who they are hiring, but in many other sectors, you're going to be able to pick this up by looking at the job ads. And then in a way, what you're getting is a sense of like what capabilities are being acquired in different in businesses. And what's interesting about that is not just maybe, for example, capabilities that tell you something about I guess the technologies that a company is exploiting, but also about the complementary capabilities that that company is acquiring in order to be able to exploit those technologies effectively. So you could imagine hiring machine learning kind of like engineers, but also hiring project managers and user researchers as a way of, I guess, creating teams that are able to create value from these technologies. So that's something I'm really excited to do, like look at the online job ads. Obviously, ultimately, online job ads are a proxy for the development of business capabilities. What you would like to do really is to basically look inside of the business and be able to measure the skills of everyone who's working there. And this is what you would do if you were LinkedIn. Unfortunately, as we, like you know, like we know researchers who work with big data sets and think and like to scrape like the web and things like that. LinkedIn have an amazing data set, but it's not one that we can use legally because the terms and conditions forbid the scraping of their data, so it's not possible to use it. Even though it's possible to, I guess, apply to be able to use the data in their economic graph challenge and maybe be able to work with it to look at these questions, I guess, with the best data set in the world for understanding what's happening inside of businesses.
Before, Juan, you go too deep into individual indicators, which is truly fascinating. But if I may sum all of this a little bit up, so for me, it looks a bit like what you just said, as there is a challenge in terms of measuring or mapping the more the exploitation side. And but then at the same time, there is also a challenge in terms of the new kinds of technologies, the new markets that are created to portray them adequately. And then at the same time, I feel a little bit like, you know, when thinking about the conceptual frameworks that we had for quite some time now, that they seem to be more advanced than the tools that we used to have when these conceptual frameworks were developed. And then at the same time, again, you know, right now we have things coming out like mission-oriented innovation and new types of innovation that suddenly challenge us or that suddenly, you know, somehow are very, very different to some extent from what we used to think when we were talking about innovation and what innovation output and outcome should be.
Yeah. So I guess we published a report last year at an event with the OECD and the European Commission where actually Daniel Candley participated, where basically what we were saying was that, I guess, we're talking about different, like, almost like waves of research and innovation policy, with like the first wave, which was, I guess, like the one that's based on the idea of market failures, and you have one based on systems failure. And I guess what we say is that now we have, I guess, a rationale for innovation policy based on the idea of emergence failure. And I guess what we say is that each of these modalities of research and innovation policy involves, I guess, different levers and require different indicators. And I guess what we say in that paper is that, you know, if you adopt a market failure rationale for research and innovation policy, what you're saying is that, you know, there are market failures that mean that the private sector doesn't invest enough on R&D because this creates spillovers and things like that. So what you want to do is get the private sector to invest more on R&D, and you give them subsidies to do that. And the only thing you are interested in is how much is the private sector investing on R&D. And that's not gone out of fashion. That's still very much a frame that informs a lot of like research and innovation policy. I guess if you adopt an innovation systems frame, you are saying, okay, it's not enough businesses invest in R&D. You also want them to be collaborating with universities, and you need to have like this knowledge exchange going on. So you want to look at the collaborations. But still, in a way, you are not that concerned about what they are collaborating about. You know, you are not really interested in looking at what's going on inside those collaborations. What you want to see is more collaborations, because you are assuming that somehow agents within this innovation system, if you somehow align their incentives, are going to be collaborating in the right things. And then you have like the third, variety, which is emergence failure. And this is what you're starting to say, actually, I'm interested in what's going on inside these collaborations. I'm interested in the purpose of the research and development activity that's happening in the private sector, because, you know, I'm concerned that not enough R&D is going into solving climate change, or a lot of the R&D is going into adverts and, I guess, surveillance capitalism and, you know, things that maybe have some, negative externalities, and not enough is going on the social challenges. So I would like to see more R&D activity within those, and mission-oriented innovation policy is that, is to say, how do we steer like research and development activity towards these societal challenges and these missions? And then if you basically have that flame and policymakers are becoming activists and actually interested in what's happening inside the lab and what's happening inside the R&D site and project, then you really need to have indicators that allow you to understand what the research and innovation activities are about. And that's where, I guess, you know, the methods that we use, like, and the methods that you guys use, like natural language processing and topic modeling and all of these things that allow you to actually look inside a patent, look inside a paper, look inside a research grant, look inside a description of a business, and start to get a handle on what is it that these things are about, and maybe what kind of like applications are being developed, and maybe even what kind of function, you know, is this like a technology that's looking to automate? Is this a technology that's looking to like inform what a worker does in the workplace? You know, actually those kinds of data sources start to become very important to generate indicators that allow, research and innovation policymakers to understand whether, R&D is happening in a trajectory that they consider desirable and that's consistent with delivering a mission. That's why we believe that these new methods, in somewhat like their day has come, and research and innovation policymakers, that's the reason that why they are so interested in them in a way that they weren't before. I remember talking to a policymaker in a business department, like, say 4 years ago, and telling them about these methods. And he was asking me, you know, why would you want to know what's happening inside the business, what the business is doing, what kind of patents is developing, what kind of like research is doing? You know, that's private sector. We are not really interested in that as long as it's happening, or in the nature of what is happening, as long as it's happening. Whereas now, you know, that same guy would be saying to me, like, no, actually, we really want to drill down and really need to understand what's happening inside those businesses and the kind of research and development activities they are engaged in, because we're interested in all of these like societal challenges and missions, and the only way we are going to be able to tackle them, or know if we are tackling them, is by opening the black box of, you know, counting patents, counting research papers, counting research collaborations, and understand what they're really about.
I have a follow-up question, but before that, I see Daniel is sitting with something.
Exactly. So that I find fascinating. And I guess when listening to your talk now from an outsider perspective, to sum it up, it is basically a growing understanding that we not only want to look at the level of investment, so how much do we invest per se, but we also want to look at the cooperation which is happening within the system. And now the last insight is, we maybe also want to look at the type of activity. And when you think of it as an outsider, it sounds rather trivial, right? That you probably don't want to just pour money within a system, but you would probably also be concerned what is actually happening with the money you pour in. That's usually the rationale every investor nowadays would be working with. That it's not only I invest in something, but I invest in something which will be beneficial for me in the long run. So the question is, why did it take us so long to realize? Is it a problem? Didn't we have the methods? Didn't we have the understanding? Didn't we have the data? Was it political trends?
So I guess it's a bit of everything. I mean, there's like this perception that, you know, in the same way which you have market failures, you have government failures. And, you know, the government failure, like Friedrich von Hayek would say, is that the government doesn't have access to the right information to know what innovations to support. And whenever the government gets into the system and intervenes, basically, it creates distortions, it gets captured by vested interests, it creates corruption, it creates all sorts of problems. So that's almost like the perception that existed, I guess, and it's almost like a very kind of neoliberal take on government. And I feel like in recent years, there's been, I guess, like a slight change in perception, because obviously we have seen that the market failures out there are not small, they are quite big. And for example, the failure of the market to, I guess, develop innovations and technologies and solutions to problems like, obviously, massive problems like climate change, or like the atrocious productivity in pharma, or like the way in which AI, which is a very exciting technology in many ways, is developing in directions which are creating big societal challenges. You know, there's a sense that, okay, so actually maybe we need to reassess the extent to which government failure is so much more than market failure. And so that's like the political side. And then on the data side, I guess we are starting to develop, data sources and methods that allow us to hopefully, this is the big question for me, you know, I guess to create intelligence, to create evidence that improve or help government manage or reduce its own, the risk that it will make these government failures. And I guess put it like design and implement more directional and activist policies in a way that is less risky and less likely to generate a picking winners style scenario.
I mean, my follow-up question here very quickly. Do you think there is a risk of ending up in micromanagement? I mean, the more you can measure, the more you maybe are inclined to see things that you would like to influence directly. And then maybe we end up just measuring the smallest details. You know, it reminds me of many organizations that suddenly implement all kinds of logging and registering, and then people just do that. Do you think there is a risk in that?
Definitely. I mean, that's like a scenario, like a dystopian scenario, like almost like a Minority Report, right? Like where you have like innovation policymakers who are almost like Tom Cruise in that movie, and like the Philip K. Dick novel, and they are just like literally almost like using all of these methods to try to almost like micromanage a process of scientific discovery, or like almost like finding, almost like trying to be there at the first workshop where a bunch of scientists get together to come up with like some radical idea. You know, and you can imagine that if that's happened, if they were doing that, that would completely distort the ability of the system to explore new ideas and develop them. So I think that there's definitely a very negative scenario where this is used for micromanagement. And obviously, there's a scenario where all of these metrics are used irresponsibly in the same way in which metrics around science science metrics and university rankings and all sorts of like measures of activity in research are used irresponsibly. It's the same risk with all of these other innovation measures. So I guess like what we really need to think about, and what we think about really hard, is I guess not just, you know, let's not just put metrics out there, and let's not just put like a bunch of numbers out there, and maybe think about also about I guess like the other organizational implications and how I guess organizations can use these metrics responsibly in a way that's not going to create all sorts of unintended consequences and negative side effects. Yeah. So yeah, that's very much in our minds. But the problem is sometimes and I don't want to be like insulting policymakers, you know, but sometimes the risk is that policymakers want very simple kind of measures, and they want very simple messages, and you give them a number, and then it's almost like they forget that behind the number there's like a lot going on in terms of the methods, in terms of the social processes that we are capturing, and there's a risk that they use them in a very naive way, and I guess, you know, there's only it's a limited extent to which we are able to control how they use these numbers. You know, it's almost like the numbers themselves are dual use technology, so we try to be
and
quite
here
careful.
I mean, one could also say maybe the whole idea how we were for the longest while, and still we are, evaluating academic output by just counting the number of published papers or sometimes citations, you know, in a way maybe you could say there is also a need to make these indicators a little bit more agile in the way how they adapt to technologies, you know, that you suddenly have a situation where, you know, a blog post or a podcast or whatever is counted as research dissemination and creation of discourse. Yeah. And maybe with the current crisis that we're now facing with COVID-19, maybe some of these dialogues will happen, and we will have to reevaluate what does it actually mean to, you know, be an education institution, organization, or what does it mean to be a research organization and to communicate appropriate to the time and technology that we have today.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, like maybe like another interesting point that COVID raises is the idea of the fact that if you are using metrics to optimize the system, you are making the system, you are optimizing it to the current situation, but you are making it fragile to changes in the situation. And, you know, in a way, if you look at, you know, the patterns of research around influenza, you know, what happened is in the last few years, you know, there was a spike of activity around it, I guess, when previous, like, almost like pandemics almost happened. And then those things were abandoned because there are no incentives to, I guess, continue doing research in areas like those. And now basically we're in a situation where everyone's rushing again to try to do that research. And in a way, the question is, how can you use metrics to design a system that has more slack and somewhat like has more diversity in the themes that it's exploring, so that maybe things that are looking a bit inefficient now or things that are looking a bit like a backwater now actually stay alive? Because we know that in the future they might be super important when an unexpected event happens. So I'm hoping that those ideas of, I guess, complexity and resilience and anti-fragility that should lead you to sacrifice some short-term efficiencies in favor of, like, more resilience is something that, again, will become more important in the way research and innovation funders think about their portfolios in the future. And that's something that would come out really directly. But
maybe thinking
crisis.
About that, I mean, that reminds me a little bit of one of my chats that I had here, the one that was with Edward Lawrence, that was talking about learning organization and some of the research he has done in terms of skill development and these kind of things. And it's kind of, maybe we should go back to the old kind of innovation system thinking, well, like, okay, let's just create a system that is good at learning, that is good at adapting, that is good. Let's create organizations that are good in absorbing and transforming new knowledge and just, you know, let it be. Yeah. In a way, because we cannot micromanage everything. But I'm not really sure, because then on the other hand, I totally see the advantage of knowing of that, being able to diagnose in almost real time to get better insight into more specific things. So it's kind of like, for me right now, it's appears almost like there's these two solutions, one that is a little bit hands off and then the other that's a bit more hands on. And I'm not sure where is the right balance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I tend to like more hands-off and less command and control kind of interventions. You know, so you could think about, like for example, missions. You know, in principle, missions are quite a light touch way to try to steer the innovation system, right? They are just saying, look, if you have ideas within this, in this intersection of domains and related to this challenge, then come and talk to us. So he's trying to almost like nudge people into creating those connections and creating those ideas. You know, he's not trying to force everyone to I guess work in that space, or they're definitely not forcing businesses to do anything really. Then you could also think about these kinds of methods using within an area which is super important for an innovation system, and maybe sometimes we don't think about so much, which is regulation. You know, in principle, you could use these methods to monitor what's the state of a market, what's the state of a technology landscape. And it's almost like a way to identify emerging risks, you know, that then might inform your regulatory activities. So it's almost like on an off switch, you know, it's almost like about detecting risks. And then once there is in certain, like say technology areas or in certain like parts of the market. And then when you detect the risk, then that's when you, I guess, start to think about how to intervene rather than, I guess, coming at the situation with an interventionist mindset from the get-go. And again, these kinds of methods could be used for that, that kind of support, that kind of like anticipatory regulation style of policy. So yeah, I think like, you're raising very interesting questions. I guess I feel that any extreme, it's almost like, you know, you could think about a continuum of modalities of intervention, from like something that's very like interventionist and very directional, and I guess very arguably maybe very much in the vein of Mariana Mazzucato, where I guess like this idea that somehow like the civil servants are like the real people with the ideas, you know, to like on the other side, like a complete laissez-faire kind of like, no, just let's just everything happen in a really bottom-up way and let the scientists decide and let the businesses decide and everything is really organic. You know, I think like between those extremes, I think we need to find what's the right balance. And hopefully I feel that some of the methods and some of the data sources we are using, because they create information that enables the evaluation of different almost like types of policies sitting somewhere within that continuum, maybe they can help us to identify where the right balance lies between both.
Yeah, no, extremes. Definitely. I mean, those are big questions, I think, and maybe questions that we'll have to deal with very soon or already now. But if you would, let's just maybe shift a little bit gears, and it's like some of the current projects that you are working on, what would you say is the most exciting stuff related to, you know, innovation performance and innovation policy?
So I guess like all of them are really exciting. So, I mean, I guess like I guess like quite a few of these projects are very much in development and with like non-published outputs. So maybe I shouldn't get into too much detail about, I guess, for example, with what government we are working or with, like what types of decisions this will inform. But I guess like, so we are, you know, like a really like interesting example is the work we are doing with one government, where actually the idea is that this government is in a country that is very reliant on one industry. And basically, we are using complexity kind of like methods to try to understand into what new industries could that country diversify in order to increase the resilience of its economy. You know, and I guess it's very much drawing on the kind of like methods from like economic complexity and the product space and the technology space and the knowledge space. And we are really like discussing with them about that and almost like trying to take those methods, which have been, I guess, generally applied almost like in data silos, like either looking at industry, like the product space with trade data, or the technology space with patent data, or the research space with publication data, and started to think about the connections between these different spaces, and I guess how the government could start to think about, you know, how what kind of interventions would help them. How do I say this without sounding very very trippy? But it's really, yeah, it's really about navigating this helping their economy navigate this multidimensional space in order to increase their diversification and I guess leverage like all of the different like capabilities that they have in different sectors that could move across them, or even like capabilities that exist in different regions that could move across them. That's like a really interesting example, I think. Another one is another conversation we are having with like research funders, and this is in the area of AI, and you know, it's like this idea of and again, I think this is something I've discussed with you, Daniel. You know, this idea that in AI, I guess modern like AI research and development, we're seeing like the emergence of a dominant design, like this technological trajectory around deep learning that has become, I guess, dominant. And some of the research funders have been speaking with, like they say, oh, you know, we are aware that maybe there's some like being like, we are aware that that this trajectory has obviously like lots of opportunities and it's like super, you know, like super interesting and super commercially successful in many markets, but also has some dangers. Like if we almost like it becomes too dominant and we reduce diversity within the AI research landscape. So, you know, it's almost like how can we measure this diversity, technological diversity in the field, and how we can use it to almost like decide what projects to fund, you know, and in some cases we will be funding projects that are maybe, you know, less on the cutting edge of the current paradigm, but are trying to keep all their like paradigms or all their methodologies alive, because we recognize that within those might exist knowledge, might exist capabilities, might exist the skills that when combined with other things might really help the field in the future, or might be relevant for specific sectors or specific like applications. And yeah, it's like this really interesting conversation about how, in a way, how do you build a funding landscape for AI that is more supportive of technological diversity and makes the I guess, makes the system less concentrated on a single trajectory. So those are just two examples of like policy oriented research we are doing, which I think is really exciting.
No, but, sorry, I sure. can't
really give, I guess, more detail in terms of like the, say, who the policymakers are and
no, but that's totally understood. Well, Juan, thank you very much. That's been amazing. Also, just to hear this whole, you know, this whole span that you're covering from the more conceptual and theoretical on the one hand, and then just all the way down to the individual indicators and, you know, bringing it back, you know, what may be the consequences of looking at one or the other or preferring one for another. So, yeah, thanks so much for joining this talk today and talking about your work.
Well, thanks so much for having us. Having me, it was also fun, and hopefully, I mean, I don't know when I'll see you next in person because there are no conferences this year. Yeah. But hopefully, see you very soon.
That has to wait for a moment, but looking forward to.
Bye.
Take care. Bye bye.
Goodbye.